This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Ya Allah, ya Rabbal Alameen.
Welcome to the Ummah Talk podcast with me, Fatima Barakatullah.
Let the Ummah rise again.
In this podcast episode, I spoke to Yoram Van Kaveren, who was a politician in the Netherlands. And it was a really interesting conversation. It was, wow, it really got me thinking about so many things. And I just wanted to bounce certain ideas off him as well, you know. I know that some people, they like listening to podcasts where you're just like allowing the guest to speak. And I hope I did that. But my podcast is about a discussion. You know, it's not just a one-way conversation. It's two-way. And it is about me sharing my ideas and bouncing them off my guests, especially esteemed guests such as Yoram. So, yeah, enjoy the podcast. Let me know what you thought of it. Like, leave a comment. Let me know, like, which ideas stood out for you, or if there's something you agree with or disagree with. Perhaps there's a point of view that I haven't considered or taken on board. I'm always open to changing my mind about things. So, yeah, share away. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam ala rasulillah. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to Ummah Talk. Today, I have with me somebody I've been intrigued to talk with. And I know that a lot of you will also be really interested to hear from. I have with me Yoram Van Kaveren, also known as the Crown Prince of Wilders. He was a famous critic of Islam. As a former member of the Dutch Parliament and a representative of the Party for Freedom, in his past, he submitted numerous bills related to Islam, such as those calling for the closing of mosques, for removing the Quran from Parliament, and for banning Islam from the Netherlands. But today, he is a Muslim, alhamdulillah, and I have his book with me. It's called Apostate, and it's all about his journey to Islam. So, assalamu alaikum, brother Yoram.
Alaikum salam. Thank you very much for inviting me on the show. It's a great honor.
Alhamdulillah. It's a real honor to speak to you. And I see that you've been collaborating, or at least speaking with Sheikh Hamza Yusuf and Professor Abdul Hakim Murad. So that's nice. How did you get to know them?
Of course, I was writing a book, an anti-Islamic book. At least that was what I wanted to do when I started writing. But during the writing, I came across so much information that was at odds with the things I thought I knew, that in the end, because I wanted to be a book of truth with a capital T, that I had to make sure that certain things that I was writing down were correct. So, and in the Netherlands, I wrote to various academic scholars when it came to Islam, but the answers weren't always satisfying. So I started writing to other authorities on this subject. And one of the persons I wrote to was Abdul Hakim Murad, a sheikh from Cambridge University. So that's how it started. And I was writing him while knowing, of course, that it was the chances were pretty small that he was writing back, because, of course, I was a member of an anti-Islamic political party in another country writing an anti-Islamic party. So there was not a real reason for him to answer me. And I, to be honest, I put a little link of my Wikipedia page in English in the mail so he would know who I was, so that he wouldn't have the feeling that I was tricking him or something. And it took a lot of days, I think 6 weeks or something. And all of a sudden he wrote back, and it was a very extensive mail with he answered numerous questions I asked. He pointed to books, articles, other persons I could ask about Islam and certain specific topics when it came to certain related topics when it came to Islam, for example, law or Akidah, stuff like that. And he says, well, if you want to know more about this certain point, you ask this person or write this person or read this book or that article. So that's how I came in contact with Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad. And after my book almost finished, I was invited by Hamza Yusuf in California. So he asked me, are you willing to do a video with me talking about your journey? And that's what I did. So I came in contact with him, and it was even before the English translation. So when I said it will be translated into English, I asked them both, do you want to write something in the book? Because I had a lot of contacts with you guys, especially Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad in the beginning. And then, they were very, of course, for me, it was a great honor that they were thinking about doing it. And when they really did write something as a foreword, it's a great honor, of course. And I hope it benefits the book.
I think that's great. So for people who don't know, you were writing a book to refute Islam, to criticize Islam, right, initially. And so you were researching for this book. And so it seems like you were really doing a very sincere type of research, because not many people who have anti-Islam sentiments would go to the trouble to actually contact, you know, like Orthodox or traditional Muslims, you know. They probably just rely on secondary sources, or, you know, their own Western academics who maybe are anti-Islam, whatever. So it seems like you, like, what made you take it so seriously that you would actually contact somebody who had, so Abdul Hakim Murad, of course, he's a convert himself, right? Was that part of the reason why you contacted him?
No, because I didn't know. I just saw his name and I thought, he's a great scholar. I didn't know him. So I didn't know he was a convert. I didn't know who he was, what his background. But the only thing I knew was the information I got from a small paper in the Netherlands. It said that it gave some names of scholars in the UK, in the US, in Singapore, Malaysia, Egypt, and other countries. And one of the persons was Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad. And I was reading what he did, came up to his study. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, this must be someone who knows a lot. So I wrote him. So it wasn't that I thought, well, he's a convert or whatever. I didn't know that.
Wow, okay.
So, no, but when I was writing my book, it has a little bit to do with my background. I was brought up in a church, and that was a pretty traditional denomination.
Which denomination was that?
Yeah, the Reformed Church of the Netherlands.
Okay. It's
specific. Well, of course, when you look at Christianity, there are three big denominations, of course, the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Roman Catholic Church, and the Protestant Church. And within the Protestant Church, there are almost 1,000 denominations. And one of the denominations I was in the Netherlands, because some are specific Dutch, that was the Reformed Church of the Netherlands. But it was a pretty, when you look at the theology and the whole culture, it was pretty traditional. And it wasn't that I was brought up in a very strict way, but the theology was. So we prayed, especially when I was young, we prayed before dinner, after dinner. We went to church. Everybody had biblical names. We were all baptized. We went to Sunday school, stuff like that. So it was real practicing Christian, especially in the family setting. But when I reached the age of around 15, 16, 17, of course, you start having your questions when it comes to religion. All youngsters have, whether you are Christian or Muslim or Hindu or whatever, you start questioning the things that you were taught. Is this the truth? Why do we believe this? Who wrote those books and stuff like that? So, and then I, for the first time, I got a little, I got my doubts when it came, for example, to the concept of God in Christianity, because in Christianity you have the Trinity, God the Father, God the Son and God the Holy Spirit. And that was the first time that I thought, well, it sounds kind of complex, a little bit illogical to me then. So I start questioning.
So that's as a teenager, right?
Yeah, as a teenager, right. So, and I was kind of a nerdy guy. I loved reading. So I read a lot of books, especially books from the scholars of my own tradition, like Martin Luther, the guy who started the Reformation and the Protestant Church, but also Calvin and people like that. And they were very anti-Islam. When you read those books, of course, it had to do with the context back then. There was the tension between Europe and the Ottoman Empire, of course. But those people were very hostile when it came to Islam in a theological sense, but also in a cultural sense, because they said, well, it's the enemy and they are a threat to Christian Europe back then. So that's what I was reading. And so, of course, that forms you. And when you ask the ministers or people in your in the church or in the denomination you are brought up in, and people confirm that, then, of course, that becomes part of the things you think that is true and that are true. So that's what happened when it came to Islam. And but when I was writing my book, the questions I was doubting as a youngster, like, for example, the Trinity, but also the atonement, that Jesus Christ had to die as a sacrifice for mankind, and his death and resurrection are essential, otherwise God couldn't forgive mankind. And that's a central dogma in Christianity, especially the part that he dies, of course, because he was sacrificed for the sins of mankind. And I always thought that was kind of strange, because in the Bible itself, especially in the Old Testament, it says that the fathers are not responsible for the sins of their sons, and the other way around. So when you're an adult, of course, when you're an adult, you're responsible for your own deeds. You cannot say, well, my grandfather did that, so now I'm saved, or the other way around. You cannot blame people for the things their father did or their grandfather or whatever, just like you cannot blame their children for you being a bad person. But when I was reading that, I thought that that's a kind of strange, because we see this concept, it's essential to Christianity, because you say, well,
original sin,
because Adam sinned, and because his sin, everybody will go to hell when you look at the denomination I was brought up in. And they said, well, there's only one way to salvation, and that is believing in the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus Christ. But when I was young, I also asked people about, for example, Adam and Noah and Abraham and Moses, and I said, well, are those people in hell? And the minister said, no, of course not, a strange question. I said, no, that's not a strange question, because you said the only way to salvation is believing in the crucifixion and resurrection
Jesus
Christ. But they couldn't believe in him because he wasn't born yet. So if that's the only way to salvation, they must be in hell. And I said, no, of course not. And then I thought to myself, well, there are probably two ways then, the old way and the old way.
Yeah, more than one way,
And so these type of questions, and it all had to do with the dogmas of Christianity, were something I was struggling with as a youngster. So when I was writing my book, those questions popped up again, because and I thought, well, perhaps I don't get it, I'm not smart enough, or it's a mystery or whatever. I parked it and I just lived my life. But when I was writing my anti-Islam book, I compared Christianity to Islam, because a lot of people think that a book is a very political book, but it isn't. It's a very theological book, because it wasn't so much that I was writing out of the context that I was a member of an extreme anti-Islamic political party, but I was a Christian, and that's why I was anti-Islam for myself, of course. And because I was comparing Christianity with Islam, the questions about, for example, the concept of God popped up again, and then I saw this concept, and of course I studied comparative religion, so I knew about Tawhid, for example, but there was a descriptive way, because you learn it as an object of study and not so much as an alternative for the truth that I was with. So when I was writing about God, for example, and I compared Tawhid with the Trinity, I thought, well, I have much more in common in a logical sense, and also when I look at the Old Testament with Tawhid concept and with the Trinity. So that's how it started. So it wasn't that I felt like I didn't want to use Western sources, because that was the question. It was because I saw that a lot of things that were written down by Westerners, all, of course, are written from a Christian perspective, especially the old books. So I thought to myself, if I really want to know what they are believing and how they are believing and why, I have to ask them.
Yes, exactly.
So that's how I ended up with the Muslim scholars.
Okay, right. Yeah, but you know, you probably know that a lot of people don't take the trouble to do that, because they'll rely on maybe just the people they know. So it's great that you took that extra effort, you know, and I think that really speaks to your sincerity, really, you know, mashallah. I wanted to ask you, like, I'm a lady who, you know, I usually wear the face veil when I go out. Not always, but, you know, I do. If in your past life, when you were in the party, if you'd come across somebody like me on the street, or I don't know where we would meet, at university or something like that, what would your reaction have been internally, like, and even externally?
I think that has to do with, because that differs, of course. It's not that all people in the anti-Islamic political parties all over Europe or the world have the same state of mind, of course.
Yeah.
But because I was a Christian, I was familiar with, for example, the hijab, and not like a hijab in an Islamic way, but when you look at nuns, for example, in the Catholic Church, they are veiled too, of course. And in the tradition I was brought up in, when you look at the denomination and the specific things you have to do as a religious person, when you look at a man and women, then you see that women, for example, have to wear hats or scarf when they enter church.
Church, yes.
Yeah. So it's not in all churches, especially not in the modern evangelical churches, but in the old churches, that is something that has to be done by the women. So it wasn't that I thought, well, she's failed, she's scary. but it was, and that was because of, I think, the Christian background, that you knew that it had to do with the concept of God. But that's something new for a lot of people. In my old party, and I know that is, for example, in other anti-Islamic parties in Europe, it's the same concept that lives there. That is that they say, well, Islam is like a colonization force. They come into Europe, and it's that they objectify it in a military sense. So what they say is the girls who are veiled or face or whatever, they are wearing a uniform. So they say they are soldiers for Islam.
Right. So,
for men, it's the beard or clothing. But girls always have to veil themselves, of course. And when you're using it doesn't matter what kind of form, but they say it's like a uniform. So they say, well, the mosques are for, so to say, their military bases. The people are the militaries, and the way they are dressing are uniform. So they, and of course, that's very twisted and a very ridiculous way of seeing it, but that's how they viewed it. And of course, it has to do with the ideology that Islam is the enemy. So what they do is they say, well, you're wearing a uniform. So in a political sense, I would say she's an enemy because of what she was wearing.
So in other words, it's like a symbol, right? It's a symbol of the Muslim takeover, right?
Yeah, true.
Of Europe. So see, because that's interesting, because when I'm of Indian origin, right? My parents were migrated to Britain, right, in the 70s. Actually, I think we're born in the same year, 79, yeah. So I was born in, sorry?
It was a good year.
Yeah, it's a good year. I was born here in London in 79. And I must say, growing up, my mom was like the only woman wearing hijab, you know, like it wasn't normal at all. It was like rare, very rare. In fact, she would get she didn't understand English, but she would get sworn at, you know, like if we were walking together, some racist people would just say something, you know, whenever they saw her because she looked so different. But slowly but surely, by the time, and even myself at school, I was the only girl wearing hijab growing up in the 90s, 80s and 90s. But now I get it, you know, like the landscape of Europe has changed. Like even UK, it's like the hijab is normal. It's like literally normal. So within, I guess, 2 decades or something, suddenly the hijab became so much more visible because this new generation of Muslims actually rediscovered their faith, right? They rediscovered Islam. Sometimes their parents were not even religious, or their parents didn't encourage religion at all. But I guess when you're in a growing up in a country where you face racism casually sometimes, and you're a minority, right? You ask yourself, like, actually, who am I? You know, am I British? Am I, what is it to be British? What is it? What do I actually believe? And so I think in a strange sort of way, even our generation had to rediscover our faith, you know? So you've been on a journey, right? But we've all been on a journey too.
Yeah.
And so that manifestation that you see of hijabis, you know, people adopting hijab, each generation probably more and more, is actually got nothing to do with, you know, military things or even political things. It's literally people rediscovering their faith and choosing to adopt it. Sometimes it's also because growing up, like when I used to observe some of the problems in society and some of the things that troubled me, like the objectification of women, you know, on television, like in the 80s, television was terrible. Like, you know, there was, women were literally used as objects, you know, like in every movie, every film. And so something inside me would always dislike that and feel that that was very cheap. And do you know what I mean? So I think sometimes even the fact that we saw the opposite of Islam, the opposite way of life in a way, enacted in front of us, and the problems of that made us feel stronger when it came to when we read about Islam, what Islam says. We thought, yeah, this makes sense because I can see the problems caused when this isn't there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And but I also think that it has to do with the fact that a lot of people are scared of the triumphs of Islam, so to say, because you said it was a symbol. And when you looked at the political ideology and the theory that we wrote for the Netherlands, when it came, we always said we have to take down the triumphs of Islam. That's why we said we want a ban of minarets. That's why we want to ban. That's why we said we don't want to have a Quran.
So it's like things that show that Islam is prominent, that Islam is growing, right?
And they say, well, we have to take it down. We have to marginalize it. We have to show them it's nothing. It's something you can walk over like a carpet, so to say.
So what are those things? Minarets, hijabs,
mosques, halal food, books, the Quran itself.
What did you say after halal food? Sorry.
Books. Yeah, certain books that they say. Well, for example, the Quran. They say, well, it's a very prominent book. Of course, it's the holy book. It's the central. Yeah. Islam. So they say when you can ban that from the Netherlands, you say it's nothing for us. It's very harsh to say, but back then, and it has been done numerous times. But they also compare the Quran with Mein Kampf, for example. And Mein Kampf was the book that was written by Adolf Hitler. But they say, well, it's the same. It's a license to kill. That's something literally that we said. Quran is a license to kill. Look at all the terrorists. So we have to take it down. It's a triumph for them, and we don't want it here.
So I'm just trying to understand the trajectory of somebody like you. So when you're a Christian, you've been introduced to some anti-Islamic rhetoric from Christian sources already, right? That's kind of understandable, right? Because of the history.
Yeah.
But then what took you from that to this party? Like, and were you fully down with what they were saying, or did you just join them because it was cool? I don't know, the thing to do, or the most aligned to what you were. Do you know what I mean?
No, I was really down. I was sometimes more down than Wilders himself, I think.
Okay.
So I was really, really anti-Islam. But it had to do, like I said, with the books, with the denomination I was brought up in. But also the first day I went to college was 9/11. So first day I was introduced to university with introduction weekend. And the first day we started really having colleges, it was 9/11. So in the morning we went with the train to the university, and then they said, well, there's something happened, something really bad. And then everybody started watching television, and it was 9/11. So I thought to myself, oh yeah, that was right, those crazy people, the Muslims. And then of course they attacked the World Trade Center, 3,000 people dead, etc., etc. But after that I started with my study, of course, and it was at the Free University in Amsterdam. So it wasn't that there weren't no Muslims, for example. I knew a lot of Muslims back then also. But when I talked to them, we never really discussed religion in a real way, not in a deep way. We never discussed
deep,
No, it was just like, okay, you are a Muslim, okay, I don't like Islam, but I'm a Christian, and perhaps you don't like Christianity. That was it. And then, of course,
so there was no like dawah
souls? Absolutely not. But after that, and I was still in college, because I studied from 2001 till 2005, before I got my doctorate. And in 2004, there was this famous filmmaker in the Netherlands. Perhaps you ever heard of him. His name was Theo van Gogh. And Theo van Gogh, he was shut down, and his throat was slit in the middle of the streets of Amsterdam by a guy who called himself a jihadi. And then he pointed...
We call him Theo van Gogh here.
Okay, yeah, okay, no. Yes. Well, he was murdered in the streets. Yeah. And, they put a knife in
his arm. Yes, I remember.
And on the knife, there was a letter as well. And a lot of people don't know that, but there was a letter for Ayaan Hirsi Ali.
Yes.
And it says, well, you will be next. So when I saw that, after I already was kind of anti-Islam, then 9/11 happened, and then two blocks away from my old house, this guy was killed in the middle of the street, slitting his throat, shooting him with a knife in his stomach. I thought, okay, well, I have to do something to protect the country against this evil, this sick ideology of Islam. So what can I do? What person is the most anti-Islam in politics? Because I thought to myself, I have to do something in politics. Then I can change the law. Otherwise, I cannot make a difference. So in 2004, before Theo van Gogh was killed, Geert Wilders split away from his old party. He was in the same party as our current prime minister, the Liberal Party. And he was the right side of the right wing, so to say, the conservative wing of that political party. And he split away because there were talks with Turkey, the country, because they said, well, perhaps you can be a member of the European Union. And the Liberal Party said, well, we have to say this is an option. But for Geert Wilders, of course, he said, well, this is crazy. We cannot have an Islamic country becoming a member of the European Union, especially not because it's not in Europe and it is our historical enemy, well, et cetera, et cetera. So he said,
and it would only increase that feeling of, you know, the freedom of movement thing would mean that Europeans were like, we're going to be swamped by the Turks, right? That's exactly the rhetoric here as well in the UK,
that's the same in the Netherlands, in Austria, in Switzerland, in France, and it's like you say, in the UK as well.
Though the Brits are a bit more polite about it. Like the Brits would never say that blatantly, but undertone.
Perhaps you're a little bit more polite, but they say here very in your face. So it's not that people are trying to hide something. Of course, I saw him and I saw, well, he must be the guy who will fix the problem. So I joined his party, and then I became a member of the Freedom Party. At first, I was a policymaker behind the scenes, so to say. But after a few years, there were elections, and Wilders asked me, don't you want to be a member of parliament? Because you studied comparative religion, so you can say something about Islam, and they cannot say you don't know anything, because you can say, well, I know something about Islam. So, and I said, well, yeah, of course. And that's what I did. And I was in parliament till 2017. So altogether about 8 years almost. And I was also in politics in the provincial states. The Netherlands is cut in 12 pieces. You have your constituencies or districts, I think, right?
Yeah, constituencies.
In the Netherlands, there you have 12. And I was a member of one of those constituencies here where I live. Also next to the job I had in parliament, but I was also in the city council. So I was in all three levels of politics in the Netherlands for 12 years altogether.
What was your subject at uni? Sorry, you said comparative religion, and what about PhD level?
Well, I'm still working on the PhD.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. Okay.
So that's something I'm doing right now. But
it's and what's the subject? If you don't mind, because I'm at uni as well, so I'm interested in.
Oh, really? Nice. Well, yeah, I'm. There's the subject about converts in the Netherlands, and way back there were a lot of people leaving for Syria, for example.
Uh-huh.
What we saw is
converts. Converts leaving for Syria. Yeah.
A lot of people were leaving for Syria. Yeah. Converts and non-converts, but when you look at statistics, and that's something, it's not really. They didn't do anything with it when it comes to research yet. We see that one out of five converts that were converted in those periods. Some people say they left for Syria, so it's an extreme amount. And when you compare it to the normal born and raised Muslim, that's extreme. So
yeah,
so how is it possible?
A high proportion. Relatively,
And how is it possible that those persons that converted go all the way, so to say, and go to the extreme? So that's something
that's interesting.
It is. But to answer your question, to finalize the answer,
I
became a member of parliament, and in 2014, I left the party. I still was in parliament even 3 years after that, but because Wilders asked during a rally, do you want more or less Moroccans in the Netherlands? And everybody
said that again. Wilders asked what? Sorry.
Do you want more or less Moroccan people in the Netherlands? And he asked that during a political rally, and everybody starts shouting less. And then he said, well, I make that happen. So he said, well, I want to expel them, so to say. And he said it a little bit different, but that was the message.
Has Netherlands got a special thing about Moroccans? Like, are Moroccans the majority immigrants or something?
One of the biggest minority groups, yes.
Why did he say Moroccans? I'm just interested to know why Moroccans.
First, of course, they're Muslims.
Yeah.
That's a thing. But when you look at the statistics when it comes to criminal behavior, when it comes to, for example, leaving school without a diploma or unemployment, something like that. He said, well, it has to do with the Moroccan people, but also with their Islamic background, because Islam is retarded. Mm. And because they are Muslim, they are stealing, they're robbing, etc. So he said, it's because they are Muslim that they do things like that.
Right.
But in the end, he made, so to say, a cut between Moroccan and Islam, and he was only talking about Moroccan people. And I find that kind of strange, because in the party, the Freedom Party, there were Moroccan people as well. Of course, they were not Muslim, but they were very secular, most of the time ex-Muslims, secular Muslims, or Christian or Jews or whatever, but not Muslims, of course, not practicing. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was kind of a betrayal, because you say, well, if you want to get rid of all Moroccan people, you're talking about your allies as well.
How did they feel about that? The Moroccans?
They didn't like it, of course. They didn't like it, but they said, well, okay, perhaps he doesn't mean it like that.
He just got a bit carried away.
Yeah, but yeah. I talked to him about this topic quite extensively, and he said, no, that's not what I say. This is literally what I say. I want less Moroccan people in the Netherlands. So, and then I said, well, I'm the spokesperson in parliament, not you, on this topic. So first, it would be nice if you inform me if you're planning
before you make a
something. Yeah, and I said, well, you're changing policies now, because it's not about Islam anymore. Mm. It's now about this ethnicity of Moroccan people. And I said, that's not why I'm in politics. I'm in politics because I don't like Islam, and I think we have to stop the Islamization of our society. So in the end, we got into a fight with words, of course, and I left the party. But I was still not liking Islam. So that's in 2014, 2015. That was when I started writing my book, because if you're a member of the Freedom Party, you're not allowed to write books on Islam, because that's the main topic for Geert Wilders himself. And he said, of course, you can write with me like a co-writer, but not yourself, because I'm the spokesperson. I'm the so to say, the symbol of anti-Islam.
Yeah. The voice of.
And then I told him, I said, well, I finally have the time to fulfill my long-held desire writing an anti-Islam book, and explaining why we are so anti-Islam. Because most of the time in politics, there are only one-liners and stupid debates. And it's not that you have the time to really explain how you feel, why you feel, take the sources, explain, etc. And I thought, well, when I'm writing a book, nobody can talk to me. I can just write it down and people will read it. So that was how it started.
Wow. I want to ask you, there's so many other questions. You know, when you tell me that story, and you, especially the 9/11 thing, 9/11, I had just had my first child, actually. I was a mom. We're the same age. So I was 21, right? 21, about 21. And I remember hearing about it on the radio as I was feeding him. And yeah, it was a shock to everybody. But since then, I'd written for the Times, just some interesting articles to explain things about Islam that they asked me to write, you know, like Ramadan and things like that. Yeah. And I got a letter from an English lady. I got a few letters. One was like a 5-page letter from a man who told me why I couldn't be so positive as a Muslim in the UK. You know, I try to convey like a positive message, but he was like, you know, these are all the things that are wrong with Islam. And it was like a 5-page thing, you know?
That's not much.
No.
It's only 5 pages.
handwritten as well. Mm. But another lady, she sought me out, and she sent me a message, and it was like, she was an old lady, elder lady. And, you know, she said, you know, someone like you who wears the face veil, you know, I just feel sad. I just feel sad because I feel like my country has changed beyond recognition. And I feel like if I met you in the street, you probably wouldn't even speak to me. And you know, I feel like the things that my foremothers fought for, in freedom for women, are being changed by you and your co-religionists. Don't you think, she said, don't you think, you know, that you also have some responsibility or something like this, you know? And she was really, it was a really heartfelt letter.
Yeah.
And initially, I've, you know, obviously when you hear, when somebody says that to you, you think, okay, you know, they've got a lot of prejudices and things like that. But I actually thought to myself, no, I'm actually going to try to empathize with this woman, you know? And I don't think we do that enough, by the way, as Muslims. And I thought, yeah, I mean, come on, you know, you've got all these, like, people who look different to you. They have a different culture. They eat different types of food to you as well. Like, you, the nature of your high street has changed. And, you know, your people... I mean, there's some things that have changed anyway about British society. Like, people don't even know their neighbors anymore. But that's got nothing to do with Islam, right? But I think on top of that, when you see this kind of very visible change, I thought to myself, you know, yeah, change is scary. Change is scary to anyone, right? Yeah. So I replied to her in a very empathetic way, you know, and I said, you know what, you're right that Muslims need to do more to build bridges and reach out and not live in ghettos and not kind of stay in their own communities. That, because I do believe that more da'wah and more, you know, and da'wah, when I say da'wah, I don't just mean preaching and you know, handing out leaflets. Yeah. I mean, knowing your neighbors, caring about your community, like feeling that Britain is yours, you know, your country that you care about, you know. And I replied in an empathetic way. And I pointed out to her that, look, I know change is really hard, but I said, look, some things that you said are a misconception, especially like about women. Don't you feel upset by the objectification of women in society? You know, if I met you, I would speak to you. And I don't veil in front of women, you know, we just veil in front of men. So I would greet you and I would welcome you to my house and, you know. But I also said to her, look, you know, my sister, she's married to an Englishman. And, you know, they have a child. And that's the future of Britain. You know, like Britain has changed. People are marrying into different cultures. And perhaps that's a beautiful thing. You know, that's something that... And she responded. And she said, wow, you know, you've really put my heart to rest. I was really surprised, actually. She said, you really touched me and really put my heart to rest. And I'm going to keep reading your letter again and again because it's really given me comfort. And I was quite surprised, actually.
But it shows the of good behavior and of caring.
Empathy, like, I think.
Like an adab. It's just showing, it's living sooner, I think.
But the reason why I mentioned the word empathy is, when you were just describing now, you as a student, you know, with whatever your background, and then hearing about 9/11, I didn't feel that your reaction was irrational, you know, the anti-Islam reaction. I thought, hey, if I was him, I would probably have reacted the same way. Because, like, who are these people? You know, who are these people? The audacity of these people who are coming to attack our... you know, countries or our symbols, you know, like the World Trade Center is basically a symbol of Western civilization, right? Like, how far have they reached, right? I can actually empathize with that. And I know a lot of Muslims don't like that, you know, they like to say, oh, they're just a bunch of racists or whatever. But I think you have to sometimes put rhetoric aside and actually think, wait a minute, if I was in that situation, if I was a young person and all I'd heard about Islam was this, and then this thing happens, yeah, I would sign up to the nearest party too, you know, if I felt strongly enough about my people, my civilization, my religion. So,
but this, the last thing you mentioned, I think that's something very important, and it's not mentioned enough. I sometimes even not at all. is religion, because, like you said to the women in your letter, that Britain changed, but Britain changed in a certain way, the same way Dutch society changed, or the Swedish society, or Danish, or whatever, Belgium, France, they all got secularized, and that's right. A big. Because when I talked to my grandfather, when he was still alive, he ended up as a 94-year-old man. And just before he passed away, I told him I became Muslim. And he was literally on his deathbed. So it was kind of hard to do because he was a minister. And then, of course, when one of your grandchildren tells you, well, I leave the truth, so to say.
Yes, yes.
That's harsh, but that's another story. But he told me, well, at least you didn't become a Catholic.
Really? Wow.
I thought, well, that's it's deep. The anti-Catholic feelings are deep. But he said, no, that's the reason he said it was, I said, well, because Sunni Islam is much more related to Protestant Christianity than you think.
Really?
So that was very special. But he told me when Muslims would have come to Europe, for example, in the 1920s, there wouldn't have been so much problems, because a lot of problems nowadays had to do with moral issues, because veiling, of course, is a moral statement, so to say. That's why the nuns are veiled as well, and that's why people in the church...
It's not a political statement. It's an act of worship, a moral...
Yeah, and it's the same when it comes, for example, of using drugs, alcohol, prostitution, abortion, dressing like you're a whore, stuff like that. And when people see it from a religious perspective, they understand it. When I say, well, what would you say if you were a practicing Christian? I'd rather 10 times, even when I was a member of the Freedom Party, I 10 times more, I want to have a Muslim, practicing Muslim next to me when it comes to the moral issues, than a hard secularist guy or girl who was living a life that I don't want to have my children in their life. So when they are, for example, walking around naked in their garden and say, well, it's just my freedom, and they're using drugs and drinking alcohol and swearing and doing all those things. And I'm not saying that all non-believers do that, but it's to explain in a
well, it's being promoted in society, yeah, right, through culture. Yeah.
And so I think that's a big problem, because normally when society is in, let's say, the 1920s, it was a Christian society. So when people say, I don't want my wife to do this, or my man do that, or I don't want to have billboards saying, commit adultery, just call or visit this website or stuff like that, everybody would understand, because you were talking about empathy for, but also understanding of religion. That's gone. Yes. And I think that's a big problem, because a lot of children nowadays are so much secularized that they're almost unable to feel empathy for religious feelings, because they really do not understand it. They really don't understand. So that's a big problem. And
Everything has been deconstructed to such an extent and relativized, right?
Yeah. And people feel lost, because the woman, and I have this conversation, I had it many, many times when I was in politics, but also when I left politics, a lot of natives, so to say, they said, well, we lost our story, with a capital S. And I said, yeah, but it's your own fault. That's not the fault of the Muslims. Because
you mean the Christian story, right? The Christian story.
Because Christianity did everything. When you look at the whole way of, especially the Netherlands, how our country is formalized, and when you look at institutions, it all has to do with Christianity. The political parties even have Christian names. People have Christian names. When you walk through the landscape, you see churches, the way we talk, our language, we have certain verbs. It talks about Christianity, everything. But people really don't understand it, because they lost their own narrative, so to say. And
Christianity has basically been demonized. It's been ridiculed so much. Like, growing up, we used to feel offended by the stuff that was said about Jesus, right?
Yeah, and that's logical. But nowadays, people don't see that anymore.
Right.
And they're almost brought up hostile to religion in general, because first it was Christianity. But I see it happening in the Netherlands. It's now becoming Islam, because Islam is the only stronghold, so to say, in a religious sense.
Yes, it's anchored, right? And people, when there's a void, when you leave a void of religion, it needs to be filled with something. And it's almost like the market, the free market. You know, like if something is not available on the market, someone comes in and fulfills that need, right?
Yeah.
And Islam has done that, basically.
And I think it's very, and I don't want to say that's the hand of God, but it's remarkable that at the same time that Europe is secularizing, all those people with an Islamic background come in. So it's almost like, okay, Europe, you're not allowed to lose your religion, so to say. And I think
I wish, and this takes me to the next question. I wish that somehow we could shift the narrative so that instead of seeing that as a curse, Europe began to see that as a blessing. I think there is a tiny shift happening right now, right? With you know, Jordan Peterson and the stuff that he's saying about nihilism and how, you know, the death of God, so-called death of God, has caused basically all of this, like, the very bedrock and anchor of Western civilization to be ripped out. I think he's awakened people to that fact, like, to the point that I don't know if you know Douglas Murray, right? Douglas Murray, yeah. In the UK. I actually met him once on a TV show. I've seen the shift even in him, right? Like, initially he was so anti-religion, even anti any religion, right? It seemed like he was an atheist, and he was like disparaging of all, and it was kind of fashionable, isn't it? Like, to be like a new atheist type, right? Yeah. Or to support them.
Especially in the intellectual scene.
But since he's met Jordan Peterson and had some of those public discussions with Sam Harris, and yeah. I've noticed that even he has started to say that actually we can't afford to leave a void, you know, like the void that we're leaving is going to be filled. And yeah. Obviously for them, it's like the radical left that are filling that void, but also Islam, right? Yeah. And I was thinking, wow, you know, like, the West is slowly waking up to that fact, you know, that, like, for example, somebody like Douglas, who complains about how, you know, Islam is basically, you know, he's written that book, The Strange Death of Europe, right? Somebody like that who complains about Islam in that way, you'd think he should be going to church, you know, he should be like, you know, getting everybody to, hey, let's revive, you know, our history, let's revive our civilization and its bedrock. But no, they won't do that. They don't go to that extent.
No, so, and I think that is impossible, because I think Christianity, it has been researched so much.
And ridiculed, yes.
It's researched so much, not ridiculed, of course. Researched so much that when you really look into the religion, you see the truth of Islam in Christianity. So I really think there won't be a revival of Christianity in Europe. I think Christianity is dead. But I do think that a lot of conservatives will enter Islam in the end. And it will take decades, but that's something that will happen. And I think that's a very good thing, because Islam is of course part of Europe as well. Because when you look at the history of Spain, you have 800 years of Islam in Spain. When you look at, for example, Bosnia or Albania, those are parts of Europe as well, of course. And yes, there's been a long exchange of ideas, exchange of culture, etc., between Christian Europe and the Muslim world. But I really think when you look at the theological concept of the first revelation for the Jews, then for the Christians, the Bible and the New Testament, Injil, yeah. And then of course, you got Quran as the final message. I think that's something, it's like a stage of Europe as well, because of course, definitely. Everybody, yeah, and I think, and I hope.
And it makes sense. It's a long, divine story that makes sense, yeah. Doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I really hope for this to happen, of course, but it will take a long time, I think.
Okay, how do we break the deadlock? Is there anything we could be doing, like, that when you look at Muslim societies and Muslim, I don't know, the Dawah scene, or, you know, because you're in the Dawah scene now, right? How can we break the deadlock between particularly the political right and Islam?
Yeah, well, I think the political right has to look at itself as well, because it's kind of funny that, for example, Geert Wilders, he always talks about defending the Judeo-Christian culture. I don't know if that's something you hear in Britain as well.
People don't usually say Judeo-Christian.
Perhaps the Christian heritage or whatever. That's something
even Christian. It's very un. I don't know if you know, like when Tony Blair, when he tried to bring God into things, you know, his spin doctor said to him, "We don't do God." He actually said to him, "Don't mention God." Like, so in Britain, you don't talk about God. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, that's a little bit different here. Okay. They talk about the Judeo-Christian heritage, and we have to defend it. But the two main parties that promote that, the leaders of those parties aren't Christian. They're not religion at all. So
they
that's
don't
kind
go to church.
They don't go. No, really. One of them really said, "I don't believe in God." So it's kind of strange. Two political parties who are talking about Christianity and defending the Christian heritage don't believe in God at all. And then there's another party who's talking about we have to stop immigrants because of they're taking over, they're making too much babies, etc. Mm-hmm. But those persons, the complete top, I was just something I was looking in last weekend. They all are not married, and they don't have children. It's kind of strange.
So basically, there's this cognitive dissonance, right? Like, we want this, but we're not willing to act it out in our own lives.
Yeah. So
don't they feel? Don't they ever think about that? Isn't that ever pointed out to them?
No, never. So if I was still in politics, I would ask them. It's like you're not practicing what you preach.
What you preach, yeah. Hypocrisy, basically.
Yeah.
That's very strange. That's what I mean. That's exactly what I see in someone like Douglas Murray as well. You know, very things that he says, you know, Muslims, they're having so many kids. They're so devoted and they're whatever. Okay, why don't you counter that by, you know, having kids and going to church and being promoted and go and, you know, encourage more society to adopt those things, right? But they won't encourage the society to adopt Christianity even, and really, it's just, so what are they offering? What do they see themselves as offering?
Well, in the end, nothing, because people say, well, it's an extreme right party. They always talk about the left and the right. I don't know if that's
same here.
The Tories and the Labour Party, of course, in the UK. Well, in the Netherlands, it's the same, but a little bit different. But when you look in essence, it's the same. But the political right used to be the Christian side, the religious side of politics. And on the left side, there were the atheists, the socialists, the communists. And but that changed. In the Netherlands, you see that as well, the left as well as the right are almost a-religious. There were two parties still here who are religious, two small Christian parties, and that's it. So all those parties, mm-hmm. so extreme liberal, so secularized, that there is no difference anymore between them, the left and the right. The only thing they're talking about now are...
Exactly.
The smaller things in life, so to say.
Yeah. And, it's the same now, here. Like, there's not that much difference, to be honest.
Admit it. And they say, well, we're fighting for the working class, blah, blah, blah. Of course you do. But that's not the real story. That's not a narrative you want to sell to your voters on the long term. And they both have no story. And I think that's a problem. And I think that is an opportunity as well for Muslims, because you ask, what can we do? I think, first of all, we have to do dawah, but like you said in the beginning, not just handing out brochures, for example, but really offering a solution in daily life.
So do you think that works on a one-to-one level? Is that where it starts? Like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm just trying to think because like you said, so many times I've come across people on the right and thought, well, we've actually got the same, we've got very a lot in common, and if only you could see that.
But they will, but it takes time, because like you said, it changed overnight for them, the society. But
so do you think people like you should be leading that? I want to know, like, honestly, like, when you see Muslims like Hamza Yusuf, and when you did meet Abdulhakim Murad, so they're obviously white Western converts, right?
Yeah.
Does that have an impact on you, a different type of impact, you know, than, I don't know, someone else who might be doctor someone, or, you know, whatever, professor something else, but not of your own in ethnicity and background? It must have a different impact.
Well, not so much for me, I think, but it is when you have discussions with people who are very anti-Islam, they see Islam as something exotic.
Foreign,
something not from here, not localized, so to say.
Right.
And when they see a white person, whether it's a girl or a boy, it changes, because in a way you're one of them.
Yeah.
And in a way, of
like,
course.
I don't think we should be embarrassed to say that, because that's normal.
That's how
even in the Quran, it says that, you know, every nation God sent a messenger from within them, right? Like, there's something very powerful in that, right?
And I think it's normal because it's a sociological truth that you are the people who look like you are the first people you go to because that's feel safe. So that's nothing strange. Chinese people have that, Dutch people, people from UK, Pakistan, Peru, whatever. So that's normal. Mm. So when it comes to bridging the gap, so to say, I think it's very important that you don't not only see people who don't look like you, but also people who do look like you. I think that the strength of Islam is the universal message, and not to be all leftish. It's not a leftish story, but I mean that everybody faces the same problems in their personal life. And everybody, in the end, as a religious person, I say you need God as the end solution. So Islam is the only religion that invites everybody, really everybody. And it explicitly say there is not a better black person than a white person. There's not a better white person than a black person. The only thing, of course, the famous hadith is that the piety and the way you act, that's you a better person. And when you look at Christianity, for example, of course, in the New Testament, there are texts that talk about equality and women and Greeks and Jews, etc. But it's not so explicitly, and it's not something that's in daily life in the current context that hits so hard, because it's not about Greek persons or Macedonian people. People talk about black and white. They say, okay, you are white, you are black. And that's something you see in Islam. It's very explicit and it's for all time. So I think the message there is so strong that even the other way around, you, for example, you look at someone like Malcolm X, who was very anti-white, very anti-American. And of course, that's logical when you look at his context, his past, etc. But he also had an experience during his Hajj that he saw a white person with blue eyes handing him a cup of water, and they drank from the same. And then he said, well, I was messed up. I was messed up. Islam cured me in a way. And I think that is something that a lot of white Europeans have to go through as well. But then the other way around, that they see, well, it's not that we have the same core values. But I have to see through the appearance of the other.
Do you think eventually the frustrations of, Europeans with the radical left, right, and the complete deconstruction that's going on, right, to the point where, for example, right now you see, like, men or people who were born men who are saying that they're women and competing with women in sports, right? Like, and stuff like that, right? Like, that must make people go mad, you know, like just seeing that, like seeing men beat up women, biological men beating up women, and that being okay. Like, you know, it's gone to that extent now, right? Do you think the radical left and its excesses is going to eventually drive Western people or Europeans to say, wait a minute, I'm done with this. Like, I'm done with this entire craziness, you know, and I need something more anchored. Do you think that could possibly lead people to Islam?
I think it will play a part. I think. But there's something else, because you asked what can the Muslims do. I think that what something very important that Muslims can do as a community is don't vote for left parties. And don't become active in very progressive organizations, because you send out mixed signals. Because on the one hand, you say, for example, I'm very conservative when it comes to family, but on the other way, you're promoting, for example, women sporting, competing against transgender men. So that's kind of
mixed. Okay, but that's really difficult, isn't it? Like, that's difficult for people, because they're like, it's like what happened in UK, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, he's just such a friend of Muslims. Do you know what I mean? Like, just as a person, and his whole support of the Palestinian cause, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, of course.
Like, but, and then you have, on the other hand, a party that's like the Conservative Party, where I know that certain moral values align, but actually the leader of the party makes fun of us. And do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. And there's Islamophobia that doesn't even get talked about. And so
it's like, the same year. It's the same
year. It's confusing yeah. for Muslims. Like, okay. You're saying don't join the left, then what? Are you saying join the right?
No, because I think you have to join yourself. And I think that's the point, because we have elections in 3 weeks here for the city councils. And someone asked me, what are you voting for? I'm so curious. Yeah. I said, yeah, I'm curious myself. Because it's like you're a political orphan. Because, of course, when I look at the moral agenda of the left, the progressive left, I cannot vote for a progressive organization because I don't want my children to brought up in a world that they promote.
Yeah.
On the other hand, when I look at the conservative parties in the Netherlands, the right political parties, they are so anti-Islam that I cannot vote for them because they
You're creating a more hostile environment.
Of course, yeah. So I'm a political orphan. So what should happen is that I think that Muslims start organizing themselves and found institutions, and not that they say, well, you cannot vote for us or you don't belong to us because we are Muslims. No, you have to start, so to say, a new conservative organization, and not only in politics, but also media and stuff like that, schools, where everybody's welcome, but we are organized out of this Islamic fundament, this concept. This is who we are Muslims, and we promote Islamic values, we promote the Islamic way of life. And of course, we don't want to impose it to you, but you are welcome to follow us as well, or join us or whatever, so that you are an open conservative party with an Islamic background, because you have to localize.
You said institution.
Yeah.
Do you mean political party? Or,
for example, political parties, but also media organizations, newspapers, internet websites, schools, stuff like that.
That is happening, though, isn't it? Slowly but surely, it is happening.
Yeah, and I think that will be the answer. In the end,
it's going to be. So do you see it as being slow, organic?
Yeah, yeah.
Inevitable.
Yeah, and a lot of people, of course, want to. A one-day solution. So, okay, this is what we're going to do, and next week it's all fixed. Yeah, that's not how it works, unfortunately. But I think in the end, about 40, 50 years, the landscape will totally be different if Muslims will be able to organize and be open to society as well. Because like you said in the beginning, I think, and that's something, because there are a lot of things society does wrong, but there are a lot of things that the Muslim community can do better as well. And that's one of them, is that you adapt the country you live in and see it as your own, because you are born here, your children will die here probably.
Yeah.
So it is your ground as well. And I think when you look at it from a Dawah perspective, the whole world is our masjid. It was all created by Allah. So you have to share the message here as well. Perhaps it's even more important here because a lot of people don't know about Islam, although there are a lot of Muslims here. So that's something that's kind of strange. So that's the message I always try to share with the fellow brothers and sisters.
I've got just two more things, please, if you don't mind. I really want to ask you. One is dawah to the elite in society. So this is something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I just wanted your thoughts on it. So, you know, like, because I was involved in a dawah organization, Aira, you might have heard of it, Abdul Rahim Green, Hamza Zorzis, etc., right? Yeah. Most of the dawah effort, I would say, is grassroots, you know, very much grassroots. And at some point, I started thinking to myself, you know, I wish that there was more effort also on the other side of society, which is, you know, the upper classes, the political leaders, in Britain, you know, we have lords and ladies, and we have barons and earls, right? And also really like highly influential people, so sports personalities, and so the new rich as well, right? And I was thinking to myself, subhanAllah, like there's this saying, you know, actually, let me just quickly bring it. I posted it on Twitter recently. Basically, Abdullah bin Mas'ud, one of the companions, he said about Umar bin al-Khattab, you know, the second caliph, he said, Umar's embracing Islam was our victory. His migration to Medina was our success, and his reign a blessing from Allah. We didn't offer prayers in the Masjid al-Haram, meaning, you know, in front of the Kaaba, until Umar had accepted Islam. When he accepted Islam, the Quraysh, so in other words, the ruling class, were compelled to let us pray in the mosque, in front of the Kaaba, right?
Yeah.
And subhanAllah, like just thinking about that, and then thinking about how the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam also, he actually devoted, although of course he cared about everyone, he did devote some special attention, sometimes even special resources to da'wah, to the upper echelons of society, right? I don't know what to call them, the elite, the establishment, the influentials, right? Yeah. And in a way, you are from the establishment, whether you like it or not, like you were, right? So I would really like to hear from you, like what you think about that, because I feel like if we could, first of all, I don't know how we would do this, but, and I'd like to hear from you on that. If we were to also exert effort or some kind of, you know, have some kind of even strategy to talk to and influence the upper echelons and the establishment, I feel like that would have a quicker impact, you know, than what's happening now, which is which is the masses, which is, you know, grassroots da'wah only, mainly, I would say. And so in a way that's organic. Maybe it's going to end up being better, because, you know, at the end of the day, the elite, you know, they have to listen to their people, right? But it makes me ask, you know, like, what efforts are being done to influence the establishment? What can we do? What do you think about my theory or what I've just said?
Well, I think it's very interesting, and I think it's true. If you want to speed it up, then of course you have to be at the places where laws are being made, where the message, the cultural message, is being ventilated. And like I said, if you start working on organizations, you can aim inside such an organization for a specific group. So, for example, if there were people in the UK, Muslims, who would organize and start their own political party, they would be elected, and they are inside parliament, and they were able to talk to the people there. They see how they live, they see how they do, how they act, what they bring. That's something that could be very strong. It's the same with media organizations. If you are just aiming for the masses, and you're just making, for example, cartoons in a very simple way, of course, it can be effective for youngsters or for people outside the elite. But some people who want to be filled more with certain theological information, or information about the bigger story of Islam, I think you have to aim for them as well, specifically. And I think you can do that by organizing yourself, by starting organizations, institutions. What we do in the Netherlands, I founded an organization, I don't know if you ever heard of it, it's called Islam Experience Center.
Yeah, I heard of it. Tell us about it.
Yeah, and what we do is that we go to schools, and where we show people, especially non-Muslims, the story of Islam through virtual reality. So we have all those virtual reality glasses, we bring them, we go to schools, we say, okay, let's, and then we have a whole class. So what we do, we start first, we have an association round, and we ask, okay, what do you think when you hear the word Islam? It doesn't matter. You can say everything. You can say terrorism or blood or whatever, or you can say the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, or the mosque. There's no good or false. So, and then we write it down on the board, or we let them write it on notes so they can be anonymous. Then we throw it in a bowl, and then I say, well, okay, I explain how the VR works. Then we look at the VR video. It's about 10 minutes. And after the VR video, and it shows you the basic stuff of Islam, the Quran, Islam, history, inventions, like a 1001 invention style. And it's all in VR. So it's like they experience it for real and by themselves. And after that, we talk about the video, but also about what they said when they were asked about what their association was with Islam. And then we say,
At the beginning.
And how is it possible that those things are so different? And then they start questioning and talking. And I think that's a good way, especially because we also sometimes go to gymnasiums. I don't know if you have that in the UK as well. That's the highest level, so to say, Ivy League schools. In the United States, you have Ivy League schools. That's a very, so to say, elite schools.
Oh, like the private.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah, it's not private in Netherlands, but it's the highest level of education you can have in high school before you enter university. And that's what we do. And we go specific sometimes to schools like that. And we have a program for those children as well. And that's different from the normal program. And you see, because we have feedback from them as well, they say, well, that's the first time somebody tells me about religion in a way that it doesn't sound stupid. And those children are the future of tomorrow, of course. Those are the elites of tomorrow. So when you start going to them at a young age and you start giving them information and tools and the truth and why it's not ridiculous to be a religious person, especially not when it comes to Islam, then you give them something that perhaps when they grow up or get older, they don't have this anti-Islam
negative association.
But also perhaps they will be a Muslim. We have two guys now, one is 21, one is what older. He told us, I became Muslim mainly because you started with it. And it is 2 years ago. And that was two of those persons are from those, so to say, Ivy League schools. So perhaps you don't
know. What did they say caused them to become Muslim?
They said, the Islam Experience Center visit, and it was just one visit.
Wow.
It was such an impact on us and the way how we see Islam. And what you gave us answers, and that's not me as a person, but the organization and the people who work with us. So they gave us such normal answers, and they explained Islam and religion in such a rational way, because I think that's very important for the Western mind. It's very rational. And they said, well, that's the first time I could relate to it. I said, well, perhaps that is the truth. So, and in there, two of them ended up being Muslim. And I think those are youngsters. So they are the future. So you don't know where they end up.
Yes, absolutely. Wow, yes. It makes me think, because my experience was like that as well at school. Like, as a Muslim, my dad is an Islamic scholar as well. So I grew up religious, you know, like that wasn't normal in that time. The Christians in my class, the religious Christians, they were always my good friends, you know. They always saw me as like, wow, she wears her hijab with pride, and we get made fun of just for being Christians, you know, without even looking different, right? And other friends of mine later on, when we left school, now, you know, however old we are, they've reached out to me and they'll say, you know what, you really impacted us just because of simple things, you know, like having certain principles, not backbiting, for example, you know, like really simple things that I just did because that was my upbringing. And, you know, like, but also sometimes they would ask me questions, you know, like, what does Islam say about this? What does Islam say about that? And the answers for them were refreshing, you know?
Yeah.
So I can definitely see the impact of that.
Yeah. And I think that can be another way of speeding up the process.
But also, Yoram, one thing I wanted to say is, you know, when I lived in Egypt, I was a student in Egypt. I think that was the first, I was 16. That was the first time I realized how much I love Britain, you know, and how British I am, actually, because there were certain values that I saw had just disappeared from what is ostensibly a Muslim society, that I felt that I had a gut feeling for simply because I was British. And I'll give you an example of that. So I remember we were in exams and this is supposed to be like a religious school. And of course, like, not all Muslims are like this, you know, with all the normal caveats. But this is a Muslim country. It's Al-Azhar, right? Yeah. I'm going to a religious class. I want to be a scholar of Islam. I want to go back to Britain, you know, like, knowledgeable, etc. And we're in exams, and a teacher comes in and tells all the students the answers to the questions. Okay.
Oh, really?
He helps them cheat, basically. And I am sitting there, you know, like, completely enraged, because I've literally last year just sat my GCSEs in Britain, okay, where we had such an amazing sense of, you know, fairness. You know, we would walk in, nobody looks anywhere else. You're not allowed to talk. You're not allowed to, you know, there's no question of cheating, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting and thinking, where did I get that sense of, like, no one here actually thinks there's anything wrong with what's going on, right? And I've just revised, and I was a really good student. I was like a straight A student. So somebody like that, when you're somebody who studies a lot, it really affects you, you know, when you see people cheating. And I was thinking, you know what? It's actually Britain and being British that gave me that sense of, that very heightened sense of, you know, fair play. It is a very British thing. I'm not saying that Islam didn't teach me that, but the British culture is what I'm trying to say, really instilled that in me. And I feel like it made me really appreciate a lot of things about Britain, like even like the politeness that we learn, that even just me as a Muslim, a British Muslim, you know, there's a certain level of politeness that you learn. There's a certain level of, I mean, there's so many good things
in
our society. So I don't want people to think that what we're talking about is like, oh, the West is so bad. And
I see
myself as a Westerner, right? Yeah. And I feel like sometimes you have to see the opposite, or the opposite of your culture, to realize the value of that British culture that is instilled in you, you know.
Yeah, and like I said in the beginning, I think it's something we have to do, because if you want Islam to be spread all over the world, you have to be a Western Muslim. Because just like someone who lives in Indonesia has his Islam in his Indonesian context, just like someone in Turkey has, or in Morocco, or in England.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
you know, we should write a book together, I think. We should write a book, I think. Bridging the Gap. That would be a good one. Bridging the Gap.
Yeah.
Would you be open to that? Seriously?
Yeah, of course. No, really. I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not joking either. You know, I've got some publishers here actually who are interested in me writing books. So okay. I really think that message is a very powerful one. Bridging the Gap, like what basically a message, I think, to Muslims, but also to Westerners.
Yeah.
I think it would be very powerful coming from somebody who was from an immigrant background, like my parents from another country, and somebody who's a native European. I think that would be
nice.
And I think we've got a lot of ideas in common, you know.
Yeah,
seriously.
I think
so. Thank you so much, Jazakallah Khair. You've really it's been very interesting. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation as well. And
absolutely.
And do you have any kind of parting message that you'd like to share?
Well, what I a lot of people ask me when I go to schools, what do you want to say to the class? Sometimes the teacher asks us. And when I'm with Muslims, and I think we have a Muslim audience, perhaps some non-Muslim who's lost is listening, but I think most of the people are Muslim. But what I always try to give them when they leave class is that they have to be aware of the fact that a lot of non-Muslims don't read the Quran and they don't read the Hadith. They read you and me. That's the only thing they see about Islam as a person.
Yes.
That's the only thing they see. And if that's a bad thing, they will think, whoa, if that's Islam, I don't want to be part of that. And if that's a beautiful thing and they see something that they say, whoa, that's inspiring, they get interested and they want to know more. So you are, and it's not always a fair thing, and it's very heavy on the shoulders of the believers, you, me, and all the other persons. You are, so to say, a card, a business card for Islam.
Yes.
So absolutely, I think it's very important to be aware of. So you can do your dawah in your akhlaq and your adab. And a lot of people forget that.
Oh, jazakallah khairan, brother Yoram. I really appreciate that. And thank you for your time. I'll let you go back to your family now. Jazakallah khair.
It's a great honor. And let's talk about the book.
Yeah, we will. We will. And in the future, I'd love to talk to you about like what you think about you know, what your plans are actually for the next 10 years, what you seek. Are you going to be building that institution that you're talking about?
Who knows?
Who knows? Okay, I think that's a good place to finish. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum salam.
Okay, dear brothers and sisters, you heard that amazing discussion with Brother Yoram. I think I got a book deal out of it as well, a book collaboration. SubhanAllah, lots to think about. Please share the Ummah Talk podcast with others. We're on Muslim Central via all the podcast platforms, so Spotify, iTunes, I think Google has its own podcast platform. We're everywhere, you know, this is available everywhere via Muslim Central, Fatima Barakatullah. So do share it with others. If you know somebody involved in da'wah organizations, etc., share it with them as well, because I'd love for them to hear, you know, this message. Please like the episode. Leave us a star rating, because star ratings actually help, you know, spread the message and help us to reach more people. Jazakumullah khairan. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته سبحانك اللهم وبحمدك أشهد أن لا إله إلا أنت أستغفرك وأتوب إليك